Just a little bit of background before we begin. The Torah, the majority of the Torah, when it was originally given, was not written down. It was in the form of an oral tradition. It was not written down until Judah the Prince in Israel, in about 170 CE, in the north of Israel, wrote down the halachic, legal aspects of the oral tradition in a series of books called the Mishnah, which he divided into six sections, known as Sedarim. Sedarim. So hence, Shisha. Shisha Sedarim. Right? Six orders. Alright, so if you get the Shin and the Samach, what does that spell? Shas. When people talk about Shas, what they mean is, I mean in Israel they mean a political party, but what is meant by Shas generally is Shisha Sedarim, which are the six orders of the Mishnah. So for about 250 years, the Mishnah was studied in Babylon, which is, of course, is modern-day Iraq, and that was studied until about the Mishnah was studied, and the conclusion of the various studies done on the Mishnah, they were recorded, just hand these to the back, just pass them down. Right, were recorded in a book called the Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, or the Gemara. That was in about 500 CE, 500 in the Common Era. The Mishnah was written in Hebrew, and the Talmud, the Gemara, was written in Aramaic, which is very, very close to Hebrew. It's written with Hebrew characters, and it is a very closely related to the Hebrew language. Rashi, one of the primary commentaries on the Mishnah and the Gemara, Rashi lived in France, born in 1040, ran a vineyard. Rashi wrote commentaries on the five books of Moses, the 24 books of the prophets and the writings, the six orders of the Mishnah, 21 volumes of the Talmud, two-thirds of the Midrash. He wrote responsa, and he wrote on the Siddur, and he wrote books of grammar. And keep in mind that he ran a vineyard as his business, and he lived during the Crusades in France, and he did not have a word processor. Okay, so that was Rashi. Hence, the way we look at Rashi is with tremendous respect. His grandchildren, he had four grandchildren, and they were the leaders of a school called the School of the Tosafot. Tosafot. Tosafot means additions. Additions. Tosafot are additions. You go to an Israeli restaurant and ask for Tosafot, they will not bring you a volume of the Talmud, they will bring you more side dishes, right? Or the waiter will abuse you. But in any case, that's the basic structure of what we're going to look at. So let's start with a Mishnah. You have here in Hebrew, yes. Yes, we're going to look at the Babylonian Talmud, but it's also in Aramaic. Yeah, that was in 350 CE approximately by Rav Munna and Rav Yossi Bar Abun. In any case, let's have a look at the Mishnah. So now, even if you don't know Hebrew, it's not necessary to know Hebrew. I have the Mishnah written here in Hebrew, and right under it, I have it in English. Now, this Mishnah is in a section called Bava Kama, which literally means, Bava means, you ever heard the old Israeli song, Bab El Wad? Bab El Wad means? No. Okay, Bab is Arabic for gate, right? And Bava is Aramaic for gate. Kama is Aramaic for first. So it's the first gate. There are three tractates, one's called the first gate, middle gate, last gate, which are the tractates that deal with Jewish financial law. Business, ethics, jurisprudence, contract law, torts and damages, etc., etc. And that is the Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Batra, first, middle, and last gate. So now, those three sections, this is one of these parts of the section, which is the Mishnah in the third chapter. Now the Mishnah says the following. I'm going to read it in Hebrew. But before I start, I want you to be trying to think of one type of question. There's two different types of questions that we think of in Talmud. Two different types of questions. One is what we call a kasha, a kushya, and the other is a sha'ela. What is the difference between a kushya and a sha'ela? Anyone know? What does the word kushya mean? Kashe. Difficulty. What does the word sha'ela mean? Question. What's the difference between a difficulty and a question? In logical terms. Hmm? No, I don't know. I think you want to answer to a Kushya as well. What's the logical difference? Let's not get psychological about this, right? What is the logical difference between those two types of queries? Right, Shaila is, I seek information that I do not know, so I ask the question. And what is a Kushya? That's right. A Kushya is more of an inconsistency, an attack, a problem. In other words, a Kushya is, there's a problem here. This doesn't make sense. Or this is contradicted. Right? Etc. A Shaila is, I don't have enough information here. Could you please tell me the information? Is this clear? Distinction clear? Okay. So now, what we're going to do is read the Mishnah. And what we're going to do is try to find a Kushya. A Kushya. A challenge. A difficulty. Okay? I'm not looking for information at the moment. I'm looking for a difficulty. So that means, now, on the one hand, it is easier, I think, to ask a Kushya than a Sha'ela. Because a Sha'ela really, it's just information. So you may need quite a background to know what information you need. A Kushya, you don't need any background. It's the logical mind looks for the inconsistency, looks for a problem, looks for a difficulty. Okay? So now, let's read the Mishnah. Hameniach et hakad birshut harabim. One who places a jug in the public thoroughfare. Uba acher v'nit kalba. Another person comes and trips over it. V'shavra. And breaks it. Patur. He's exempt. Example. You put outside your house on the sidewalk. Now, I don't know how it is in all places in the United States, but in Australia, right, we have on the sidewalk, right outside the fancy house, there's a small strip of grass. Then there's a sidewalk. Then there's another strip of grass. Now, those strips of grass are public thoroughfare. They're public property. The owner of the house is required by council law to take care of them, but they are really public property. Okay? Now, I, for instance, happen to like garden gnomes. You know what garden gnomes are? Those little clay figurines of stuff, you know, you have, right? So, they look stupid. Actually, there's a garden gnome liberation front in France that kidnap garden gnomes from people's gardens and take them back to the forest where they belong. So, don't laugh. It's a worthwhile cause. No one else is worried about them. Anyway, so it's something for liberals to do, you know. So anyway, so you take your garden gnome and you put it outside the house on the little strip of grass, which is a public thoroughfare. What it's saying here is this. Someone walks along and breaks it, trips over it and breaks it, they're exempt from paying you for the garden gnome. Do you have any questions here? Any Shaila? Let's look, quest for information.
Who owns the garden gnome?
I'm sorry?
Who owns the garden?
The owner of the house.
If you're exempt from paying, if you break it.
He put it in the public thoroughfare. I walk by and I trip over it and break it. I don't have to pay him. Now, is there enough information really to know is there enough information here to process such a law? No, what else would you need to know? I mean, would you think it's logical that the guys, it's not on the sidewalk, it's on the piece of grass. So I'm walking by, and I'm walking on the grass, because I like that springy feel of grass. I don't like the sidewalk. So, and I knock it over, and I break it. So I should be exempt? Does that sound reasonable to you?
No.
I suppose, yes. One quest for information would be, well, what's normal? Is it normal to run on the grass, to walk on the grass? Is it normal to be on the sidewalk? Right? You have to know, I think, to a great degree, a law like this would depend on what's the common custom of the place. Right? Where do people walk? Where do people run? Okay? So that's something you'd have to know. Yeah? Did you deliberately kick it over or not? Well, look at the Mishnah. You tell me what the answer to that one is. Did he deliberately kick it or not? What does it say in the Mishnah? He tripped over it. That sounds like, if he deliberately kicked it, he's not exempt. He's got to pay, right? That's what it sounds like, right? Because it says, Mikal, he tripped over it. Yeah? Yeah, that's what we mentioned before. You'd have to know what the common custom is, right? Where do people walk? And you're right, you're looking at it from the other point of view, right? First was, where do people walk? Where it's normal for people to walk? The other question is, where is it normal for people to put their garden gnomes? Okay? So that's another question you'd have to know. Right, for instance, in Israel, in Jerusalem, there's a place called Machane Yehuda. It's a marketplace. Okay? Now, Machane Yehuda is on just off Jaffa Road, and it's quite common for people to spread out a blanket on the sidewalk, and put out jewellery, and the guy sits there selling jewellery. At Ben Yehuda Street, people do that as well. Right? Kids, about the, towards the end of the school year, there's like hundreds of school kids sitting on Ben Yehuda Street selling their old textbooks. Right? And you cruise up and down and you buy textbooks. Okay? So they're all sitting on the sidewalk with blankets on the ground with the textbooks on it. So I'm walking along. I say, public thoroughfare. Crashing over the jewellery, right? Kicking the textbooks aside. Get out of the way, kid. Right? You know, walking along. Is that okay? No, I tripped over it. I mean, so you have to know where it's normal to put things on the sidewalk, where it's not. There's one other factor, which we didn't really think of, is supposing it is on the sidewalk, but do I have an obligation to watch where I'm going as a pedestrian? Do pedestrians have to watch where they're going? Presumably. So is it an excuse to say, I didn't see it? What do you mean you didn't see it? It's a 3-foot-high garden gnome. How can you not see it? I wasn't noticing. Right? Is that reasonable? So we have to know, when is it reasonable to expect, how much do you have to expect a pedestrian to watch where he's going? Or how much is he not expected to watch where he's going? Right? What if the guy is obstructing the public thoroughfare? Am I allowed to deliberately push this out of the way? Give you a scenario. Right? I have a, let's say, I own a four-wheel drive Range Rover with a very large bumper bar in front, one of those cow catcher things, and someone has parked their Fiat, little Fiat, right? Fix it again, Tony, F-I-A-T, right? They've parked a little Fiat, right, outside my driveway. Now, I need to get to the office. By the time I call the police and they get a tow truck and they pull the Fiat away, right, I'm going to miss an appointment. But since I have a four-wheel drive Range Rover with a large chrome bumper bar, and this guy's got a pathetic, nerdy little Fiat, right, so I could theoretically drive my car out the driveway and push his car out of the way with my bumper, suffering absolutely no ill effects to my car. His car, of course, would get dented, scratched. But hey, he obstructed me. Would that be allowed? Would that do that? Not clear. It's not clear-cut. When are you allowed to take the law into your own hands? When are you not? Right? If someone's obstructing the public thoroughfare with something, and I need to get past, and I cannot get past, and I'm losing money, I'm losing income, I'm losing time as a result of this, maybe it's appropriate, maybe I can do so. That we don't know. Because the Mishnah's talking about tripping over. The Mishnah doesn't talk about the case of deliberately doing it, because maybe the Mishnah's talking about a case where it's not really obstructing the thoroughfare, it's just there. So that, we don't know any of this. Yeah. Another good point. In other words, if we do say that the pedestrian is obligated to watch where they're going, right, that may be very true. But what about at night? What about when it's dark? Right? So now, every single one of these questions are all discussed in the Gemara. Every single one of these, the Gemara spends quite a while discussing each of these questions. Before we get there, though, let's finish the Mishnah. One who places a jug in a public thoroughfare, and another person comes and trips over it and breaks it, the person who breaks it is exempt. Does everyone have a copy? Good. V'im huzak ba, and if he is injured by it, that means this person who tripped over the porcelain garden gnome or something like that, he's wearing very fine Italian leather shoes with a thin sole, and the shard comes through his foot. Ah! Right, he hurts himself. Okay? A friend of mine happened to him at his wedding. He got these very fancy shoes, thin soles, and under the chuppah, you know what the chosen does? The last time he gets to put his foot down, he goes like this, right? And he breaks the glass and he screams. He had to go to straight from there to hospital to get stitches in his foot. Okay, so he did come back to the wedding, but it took an hour, right? So anyway, you know, this is a good argument for, first of all, using very thin crystal glasses, not those thick Duralex monsters, right? And also for wearing Doc Martens at a wedding. Okay, now, Vim Huzakba, or that too. Right, Vim Huzakba, so if he's injured by the shards, Bala Chavit, the owner of the barrel, Chayav ben Izko, must pay damages. Okay, in other words, if he's injured by it, the owner of this object must pay him for his damages. So according to Jewish law, if you cause injury to someone, you must pay them for damages. Interesting, Jewish law requires that you pay 5 different types of damage to someone if you injure them. What are the 5 types of damage you must pay to a person when you injure them? what's called, first of all, you must pay for their medical expenses. You must pay for their pain. How do you measure the financial value of pain? How do you figure that out? How much is it worth to have pain? I mean, what pain? How do you say, he broke my nose? Oh, that's a $50 pain. Right? I mean, well, how do you figure that out? So the Gemara says, very simple. The Gemara says, will you say this? If he had to have the same procedure done for medical reasons, and he could have it done with an anesthetic or without an anesthetic, how much, what's the market value of anesthetic to alleviate the pain of a broken nose? Okay? So, that is the market value of the pain for a broken nose. Right, plastic surgeon sometimes has a broken nose. You know, you walk into the office and they need a nose on, the plastic surgeon comes in and went, oof, right? So, I don't know if they do it that way, but let's say, right? So now, you could do that with anesthetic, you could do it without anesthetic. Okay, so what's the value? How much does it cost? That's the value of pain. Okay, so you have to pay medical expenses and you have to pay for pain. What else do you have to pay? Loss of income, that's right, the loss of income, his unemployment benefits while he is recuperating or injured. You also have to pay for shame, yes, boshet, pain, shame. How do you estimate that? That's a lot harder to estimate. That's up to the court to estimate the shame that the person has felt from it. Depends what it is. Right, walking around with a bandage on your nose? Yeah, I mean, that may be worse than if you broke your pinky, right? That's not a different, it's not the same thing. And finally, nezek, which means damage. What does that mean? That means the lowering in his value. Everyone's got commercial value. Everyone's got commercial value, right? This is what actuaries try to figure out in insurance companies. What's your commercial value? Well, I reckon he's got to live this long, right? He's got this and this many skills. Right, he's got this ability, he's got this what, whatever, 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 right? He's worth a few million. Okay, in the ancient times, you just say, well, slaves are worth this amount, right? A slave with this problem is worth less. A slave with this advantage is worth more. So that's the financial value. So, for example, if you're talking about Vladimir Horowitz, the great pianist, and you broke his fingers, the loss in value would be significant, right? You know, he gets like 50,000 whatever for a half-hour performance. Right, you broke his fingers, he can't play. I mean, that's a significant loss. On the other hand, you've got an American football player and you broke his finger. Does that make a difference to him? I mean, he can still kill people on the field with a broken finger. It's no big deal, right? It's an advantage if he's got a little plaster there. Right, so therefore, right, you have to look at the lowering in value as well. Okay, so those are the five types of damages. Sar, Ripui, Shevet, Boshet, and Nezek. Okay, so you have to pay those damages, okay? A human being, by the way, a human is always responsible for full value of damages that you cause, even if it was not deliberate. If I hurt someone, even if it was not deliberate, then I must pay, with some exceptions. But let's say, I mean, I was standing in the street in Jerusalem, I was standing on the sidewalk, and traffic's coming this way, and I stuck my hand out to get a taxi. I went like that, right? And there was a person walking on the road against the traffic, right? And he right into my hand. Like that. Ooh. Oh, and I turn around, I'm sorry, oh my gosh, thank God he was not injured. But had I injured him, I would have to pay. I would have to pay, even though it was not deliberate. Humans have to be responsible for the consequences of their actions. Because I am human. Okay, Gemara says, even if you cause damage while you're asleep, you may have to pay. For example, let's say next to our beds in the hotel rooms, they have these lamps. Now, supposing I go to sleep and I thrash around, I have a nightmare. And in the nightmare, I'm like thrashing around, I smash the lamp. Do I have to pay the hotel? Jewish law says yes. Why? I saw the lamp there before I went to sleep, didn't I? So I know it's there. If it is the type of thing that I do anticipate that I might thrash around and break it, in other words, it is my responsibility and I have to pay. Right, so, however, what if it's an extremely fancy hotel, right, and during the middle of the night, maid service comes in and puts a vase of fresh roses and carnations so that I wake up to their smell in the morning. Okay? Supposing. Right? And then, and during the night, I smash that too. So, what would be the law there? I'm not responsible. That's totally beyond my control. So anyway, let's look back at the Mishnah now. Have a look at the Mishnah. Right? Hameniach is a kadbish, a rabbi, one who places the jug in the public thoroughfare. And another person comes, Ubacher v'nik kalba, another person comes and trips over it, v'shavra and breaks it, patur. He's exempt. Vim huzakba, and if he's injured by it, balachavit, chayav b'nizkor, the owner of the barrel, is obligated to pay his damages. Now, we've gone through quite a few of the she'elot, right? We've gone through quite a few of the requests for information, which if we have time, we'll look into. But before we get there, I would like you to ask me a kushya, meaning a difficulty in the Mishnah. Yes. Excellent. I'll repeat it. The question, the kushya, the problem in the Mishnah is this. The Mishnah starts by saying, one who places a jug in the public thoroughfare and someone trips over it and breaks it, he doesn't have to pay. But if someone is injured by this barrel, the owner of the barrel has to pay. So immediately we look at this and we say, just a second. Starts with jug, switches in midstream to barrel. Is it a jug? Is it a barrel? What's the answer? Right? In other words, the question is clear. Right? That since the Mishnah was written by Judah the Prince, great legal scholar, great legal authority, the legal code of Judaism that has lasted for 2,000 years, right? And he's writing this as a legal code, you'd think he'd be a little more careful than Tom Clancy. You know, you'd think he'd put in consistency in the words, right? Jug, barrel, don't switch on me in mid-sentence, for heaven's sakes. Right, so what is the explanation here? That's the question. Is the question clear to everyone? Okay. Anyone have any answers to this?
I have a question.
What? Why does he want to be vague? Why would you want to be vague? What do you gain from that? Is there a better way to be vague? As you're saying that the Mishnah deliberately wants to be vague in order to say that I shouldn't pay too much attention to the details of the subject. Is that what you're saying? Right? So isn't there a better way to be vague about it? Well, forget politics. But I mean, that's not involved here, right? Just because you have American elections here, the whole world's not interested in that. Right? But I mean, but again, it's a good point. Right, it's a good point. You're saying maybe he wants to be vague. Well, no, that's, this Mishnah is not, no, I don't see that in the Mishnah. But what we're talking about is, you want to be vague, but what I want to say is the following. Okay, if I want to be vague about the type of object, wouldn't there be a better way of being vague? What would be the better way of being vague? Say an object. There's a word in Hebrew for object, okay? You can say, he put his object in the street, the guy slipped over it and broke it, he doesn't have to pay. And if he was injured, the owner of the object has to pay. That would solve the problem. Yeah, all the way back. There's an interesting idea. Interesting idea, just a second. There's an interesting idea that a jug, what's a jug?
Massive.
No, a jug is usually a small thing compared to a barrel, relative to a barrel.
Massive.
Barrel is massive, jug's small. So what you're saying is that maybe the Mishnah is telling us doesn't matter how big the object is, the law would be the same. Is that what you're saying? Okay, that's a distinct possibility. Yeah. Well, that's what we're saying here. We're saying whether it's big or small. Yeah.
My question for you is, you said the cannabis or the accident being somewhat knowingly, unknowingly, lack of
care. Really,
do you
see
what that does
to the
concept of
sacredness? Certainly does. But
when it comes to holding someone responsible while he's sleeping, so knocking over a dog, that he's implies to leave negligence is not sufficient.
No. We would say that negligence indeed is something which a human, if it's a negligence which is a type of negligence that you could have anticipated, then you're obligated to pay. If it's negligence which you could not have anticipated, it's not really negligence. So I suppose the category is a little moot, because if it's something you could have anticipated, you're not exempt. If it's something you could not have anticipated, you're not negligent. Okay, so let's get back to the jug and barrel. I don't want to get distracted too much, right? Yes, you have another answer? Okay, yeah. Actually, well, nowadays, in modern usage, that's true, but in ancient Babylon, barrels were often made of clay as well, so that wouldn't work. That wouldn't work. But so now, yeah. Well, that's a possibility as well. Let's deal with, I think, probably the most obvious answer, and we'll try to deal with that first. The most obvious answer is that jug and barrel means to tell me small or large objects. So the Gemara, now the other answer, what other possibility could there be? It's a typo. It's an error. It's an error, it's a mistake, you know, it can happen. Everyone makes mistakes, except for me, but I mean, everyone else makes mistakes, right? So maybe it happens, maybe it just happened. So now, the Gemara now does the following. The Talmud says, well, okay, here we have a discrepancy in the Mishnah. How would we be able to see if the answer that you have given is correct, and at the same time eliminate the possibility of it being a mistake? What methodology would we use to figure out if your answer, big, small, is correct, and also at the same time show that it's not a mistake? What would you suggest? Or, yeah, that's correct. That would be the simplest thing. If you want to do a little literary criticism, right, you want to do some analysis, the first thing you'd have to do is, let's see how the words are used in other places in the Mishnah. Okay, that's what we'll do. So that's what the Gemara does. So the Gemara brings two other cases where you find the same usage. One case is this. A person is walking in the public thoroughfare with a jug on his shoulder. Guy behind him is walking with a beam. We can already see something developing here. Okay? One guy's got the jug, the other guy's walking behind him with a beam. And they're both walking along. Right? Okay, they're walking along. And anyway, the guy in front, and it's in the fast lane. Right? So they're walking along. And the guy in front with the barrel stops for a moment. And the guy behind him with a beam, oh! And he smashes the guy's barrel. Chuck, was it? Did I say barrel? You're right. Because the Mishnah starts off by saying jug and then switches to barrel. So in other words, we find another case where the Mishnah does exactly the same thing. It starts off talking about the guy's jug on his shoulder, and now it's talking about a barrel. Now, what does that mean? Does your answer still hold water? Excuse the pun. Does your answer still hold water regarding the jug and barrel scenario here in this case? Wait. But does the answer of it being big and small, deliberately changing it to show me it doesn't matter the size of the object, would that apply in this case? Clearly not, because if it's on, it's irrelevant. It's on his shoulder. It's a traffic law here. We're talking about traffic law. That's where we can derive about traffic law from this Mishnah. But it's irrelevant what the size is. So what we've done is, A, we've shown that size is not, the answer of size doesn't make it, is not relevant here. Now, have we established that it's not a mistake? No. I'll tell you why. The Gemara likes to see it three times to establish a pattern. So therefore, the Talmud now quotes another Mishnah, a third Mishnah. The Mishnah says this. A fellow is walking along with a barrel of honey. And another guy is walking behind him with a jug of wine. As this guy is walking along with his barrel of honey, it splits open. So the guy with a barrel of wine tips out his wine and collects the honey from the other guy's jug. Because honey, gram for gram, cc for cc, is more expensive than wine. And therefore the guy behind wants to do a good favor, right? He wants to do a mitzvah and collect the honey from this guy's barrel or jug. Or was it both? Right? So there also the Mishnah does the same thing. It switches between jug and barrel. So what does that tell me? Now I've got three places in three totally different contexts. One's in the area of torts, one is in traffic law, and one is in the return of lost property. And in no, so therefore, any answer I give to why it switches has got to be according to Occam's razor. Remember we discussed that the other day? Occam's razor, William of Ockham, the English philosopher, who said that in science, the best answer is the simplest and most elegant answer that shows the pattern that connects things.
This exactly is what Rav Soloveitchik says is what the Jewish principle of chazaka is, which is, if I've got three cases and I can answer each one with a separate answer and disconnect the phenomena, or I can give a simple, elegant answer that will explain all three in a uniform, logical fashion, what would be my preference? The last, that's right. The second, the simple, elegant, linking answer. So now I've got three places where jug and barrel are interchanged within the same sentence, and obviously any answer that doesn't take into account each one of those three cases is not going to be the ideal answer. What would therefore be the logical answer that will answer why it is so in all three cases? What would be the logical answer? That's right. They're synonyms. It's interchangeable. It would be, if I'm reading a book, and in one place it says, James Bond took out his gun. And then a chapter later it talks about James Bond aiming his pistol. And then a chapter later it says, James Bond lost his weapon. Now, I would say in each case, it's a synonym. These are synonyms. Okay? So, jug and barrel, apparently, in Israel in 170 CE, jug and barrel evidently were used interchangeably as synonyms. Okay. Now, the next question the Gemara asks is, what's the next question you would ask? Next stage two of this. The question is, so what? Who cares? Right? You ever heard of Roger's thesaurus? Roger's thesaurus cares. But why should the Mishnah care? Right? The Mishnah is there to teach me Jewish law. It is not to teach me usage, right, of Hebrew words for jug and barrel in 170 CE in northern Israel. That's a subject for a PhD thesis. It's nice and useless, right? And basically it's some arcane subject that no one knows about, right? And it's perfect. It's the ideal subject, right? But that's not the purpose of the Mishnah. The Mishnah wants to tell me practical Jewish law. Practical Jewish law is not served by mixing me up, confusing me with jug and barrel. So what? They're interchangeable. What possible ramification could there be in law if two words like that are interchangeable? Yeah. Confirm what? That's clear. Well, yes. So, well, Jewish law uses that as well. But the three cases are radically and totally different. One's got nothing to do with each other. The only thing in common in the three cases we mentioned is the words jug and barrel are interchangeable. That can't be the answer. And so the most obvious answer is jug and barrel mean the same thing. But now we've got to ask ourselves the question, so what? What is the ramification of the interchangeability of these two terms? Can anyone think of an area of law where it would be significant that two words are interchangeable? Why would that make a difference what the terminology is? Whatever the heck the thing is, take it to an assessor, he'll assess the value and that's it, you'll pay. So then you'll cross-examine him, and you'll say, you mean a big thing like that, you mean a little thing, you mean a round thing, what do you mean? Right? If it's a court case, we're not worried, because court cases is cross-examination. But you're close, you are hot. Yeah. Contracts. What type of contracts would it be important to know that words are interchangeable? Verbal contracts. Buying and selling things. So for example, if you would go into a store in England, you'd walk into Harrods and say, and you're American, and you'd say, I'd like to buy a pair of pants. And they'll say, certainly, sir, just over that area. Right? And you walk over and ask to Mr. Simpson. So you walk over, hi, Mr. Simpson, I'd like a pair of pants. He takes out a pair of briefs. You ask, no, pants, man. You mean trousers, sir? Yeah, okay. So, now, obviously, there would be differences. So now, depending on where you live, right, different terms mean different things. I mean, you know, just in Australia, for example, a term of endearment of two very good friends is calling someone an illegitimate child, a bastard, right? So, for example, I was in Singapore airport, and I was on this flight with an uncle of mine from Sydney, and we arrived in Singapore airport, and it so happened that a flight from Perth, Australia, arrived at the same time. And from across the lobby in this part of the airport, my uncle sees a friend he had not seen for 10 years getting out of the departure gate. And they see each other, and they both yell at each other, "Harry, you know, and they're running at each other. And of course, a number of policemen in the Singapore airport are walking over. They think there's going to be a punch-up here, right? These guys just yelled at obscenity at each other, and they're running at each other. And, you know, the policeman's walking over there, and my uncle and the guy embrace. "Oh, so good to see you, man." Right, anyway, so the way we use terminology is different. So now, but when it comes to buying and selling, right, verbal contracts, it's quite important. So let me give you a scenario. Supposing in our particular area, jug and barrel are used interchangeably. Let's give the Israeli scenario. In Israel, there are new immigrants and there are Israelis. Now, new immigrants learn Hebrew in an ulpan. And Israelis learn Hebrew just, they go up with Hebrew. Now, if I would walk into a bank and I would say, Slicha, Boker Tov Adoni, then first of all, they'd immediately know that I'm an immigrant because I say, "Good morning, sir." Right? So, right? Then I would say, Birtsoni liknot pinkas hamcha'ot nosim. I would say, it is my desire to buy a book of traveler's checks. Hamcha'ot nosim. Or I just want hamcha'ot. Now, what would the clerk say? The guy would say, you know, let's check him. You want checks? Say checks. Right? In Hebrew, no one says hamcha'a, which is the Hebrew word for check. Everyone says check. Check. Right, so they're a little sloppy about the way they use Hebrew, right? The new immigrants are a little less sloppy, right? So now, supposing you live in a city, it's all Israelis, and all the Israelis say jug and barrel interchangeably. I am the only new immigrant in town, right? And I walk into the local store, and I say, "I'd like, here's 30 shekel, I'd like a jug." He says, "Fine, we'll deliver it to your house." And I say, "Great." So, you know, a day or two later, guy comes to the house with a barrel. I said, "Slicha, aval, you know, excuse me, but that's not what I ordered." He says, "What do you mean? You said jug." I said, "Well, I know, this is a barrel." He says, "Huh?" He says, "Who taught you Hebrew? What are you, sons of a new immigrant?" And I say, "Yeah, actually." Yeah. And he says, "Well, that's too bad." So I say, "Well, look, take it back. I don't want it." He says, "Fine, we'll take it back. And delivery charges will be 5 shekel, please." I said, "Why should I pay delivery charges? You made the mistake." And he says, "No, you made the mistake. Who is right according to our Mishnah? Who's right? Who's he?" Well, you see here, I would say the following. I don't think it's possible to produce a verdict at this point. Why? Because, you see, it is possible. But I would say the case is this. Since everyone in the city uses them interchangeably, you, as the sole person who does not, clearly, right, are in the wrong. Right? It's you against everyone. It's ridiculous. Right? You have got to conform to the mode of speech of the vast majority of people in the place. If it's me against the entire town, then of course I lose out. Right? And you're right, the delivery guy is correct. I've got to pay the 5 shekel. Right, and then hope that the next time he'll deliver a jug, okay? Or a barrel, whatever it was I wanted. Now, so the Talmud says, is that what the Mishnah's telling us? By interchanging the words, is the Mishnah telling us that that's the case, in that case, you will lose out if you're the customer? No. You know why it can't be that case? It is, as my son calls it, the duh principle. Duh. What does duh mean? Yes. That is to say, the Gemara often will say, "Well, pshita, pshita." This is obvious. My son, when I learn Gemara with him, says, "So the Gemara says, duh." I said, "Look, Avraham Shimon, the Gemara never said duh." Right. I said, "The Gemara said, it is obvious." Right. He said, "Didn't say that either, it's Aramaic." I said, "Well, fine, but pshita." But it wouldn't, I said, "Have one of the Amoraim, authors of the Gemara, come to our century and said, this is obvious." He would not have said, "Well, duh." Right? So don't use that term. But anyway, but it's the duh principle, which is The Mishnah is not there to tell me things which are blatantly obvious. It's blatantly obvious that if it's me against 5,000 Israelis in the city, I am going to lose. I'm wrong. Clear. Because everyone uses it interchangeably except for me. I should clarify. So what about the other extreme? The other extreme is what? It's a city, it's an absorption center in Israel. All new immigrants. Everyone's a new immigrant. Right? Except for me. And I run the store. And I'm an Israeli. Okay, so a new immigrant comes in and says it like a jug. I send a barrel to his home. Who's right? He is. Right? Why? Because it's him, it's me against everyone. So the two extreme cases clearly are not what the Mishnah's talking about. Yeah. Well, okay, but let's try to eliminate exacerbating factors. Let's try to eliminate those type of factors and just get down to the principle. Which means there could be other factors. You know, it could be he'll know from my passport, it could be he'll know from where I look. But let's eliminate all that, just get down to the language point, okay? So those are two extreme cases. They're obvious. The Mishnah doesn't need to tell me those cases. What case, therefore, will the Mishnah really be talking about? When there's a mix. What type of mix? If it's a 99-1, that's obvious. If it's 1 to 99, it's obvious. Well, that 60-40, I think, is the case. You know why? Because of this. If I have the majority of people, like a 60%, 70% majority, speaking precise Hebrew, and I have 30% who speak imprecise Hebrew, okay? Now, what would I normally think? Without the Mishnah, what would be my first thought? A priori, how would I approach the situation? What would I think? I would think majority rules. I would think the majority rules. I would say, look, I'm sorry, 60% say this, forget the 40% are out. What is the Mishnah telling us? In a subtle way, what is it telling us? The majority does not necessarily rule. Meaning, if I've got 70% who speak precisely, and I've got 30% who speak imprecisely, am I allowed to ignore the 30%? No. And let me give you two examples. One is from Rashi, one is from the Talmud. Example from Rashi is the following example. In Israel, actually anywhere, there are two uses for oxen. What are the two uses for an ox? Plowing or eating. Right? No one has an ox as a pet. You know, could you take him out for a walk tonight? Oh, you know, okay, I'll hitch him up to the plow. No, an ox is either eaten or it uses for plowing. Now, there are two types of oxen. What are the two types of oxen? A normal ox that you can hitch up to a plow and it will just, like, go back and forth and it'll be fine. Or a nutcase, a crazy ox. Right, a crazy ox is one, you hitch it up to the plow, right, it sees a fly, whing, your field ends up looking like something out of Salvador Dali. Okay? So now, I go to the local Ford ox dealer, and I say, I'd like an ox, please. And he says, certainly, sir, here's an ox, never used on Shabbos, right? And here it is. So I say, good, okay, how much is it? Just, you know, 50 shekel, whatever. So I pay him for the ox. I take it home, hitch it up to the plow. One thing I forgot to mention, what a majority of people use oxen for? Plowing. Most people use oxen for plowing. Very rare they eat. I mean, it's not that rare. 10-20% of the population eat them, but the rest use them to plow. So, hitch it up to my plow, I go off, right, the ox is like, right, my field's hopeless. It's hopeless. So I take it back to the dealer and I say, look here, my good man. This ox is useless. What do you mean it's useless? Did not taste good? I said, what do you mean taste good? I use it to plow. I and 70% other people use it to plow. You sold me a lousy ox. I want my money back. Now, does he have to give the money back? Correct. You're right. He does not have to give the money back. Why? Because I'll tell you what. Wait. I made the mistake. Let me explain. I made the mistake of this. I walked into the store saying, I am from a holy majority that plows with the ox. He should assume that I'm from the majority. Now, the storekeeper says, if he wants an ox to eat, he should say. If he wants an ox to plow, he should say it. Maybe it's from the minority. How am I meant to know? What, sorry? It's an ox dealer. Oxen are sold for two purposes, plowing or eating. Doesn't say what, you know, you walk in, you buy an ox is an ox, far as you know. But now, so, what? I'm just 1 second. The point I'm making is this. What the Mishnah is subtly telling us is that we don't automatically follow the majority. The majority, i.e. the plowers, we'd have to come into the store and say, excuse me, look, I'd like an ox for plowing. Now, why don't we follow the majority? So the way it works is like this. You see, who is more likely to explain themselves? Someone from minority or someone from the majority? The minority. In other words, psychologically, the minority is more likely to explain themselves. The majority are much more likely to assume the minority does not exist, not explain themselves, not clarify, and say to heck with them. So now, the Mishnah wants to even out the playing field. How do we do that? The legal burden of clarification is placed on the majority. Because the psychological clarification burden of clarification is already on the minority. Now, hopefully, both sides will clarify. And that would lead to a better and equitable and more peaceful society. So therefore, we don't follow the majority here. Because we say, I cannot assume the minority doesn't exist. If I am the owner of the store and a person walks in, I cannot say to myself, well, I'm assuming he's from the majority because minority don't exist because there's only 30% of the city. Does 30% of the city not exist? Anyone live in a city where there's a minority population of 30%? Probably. Do they exist? I'm sure. Of course they exist. Right? For me to say they don't exist, for me to not clarify is like saying they don't exist. In that sense, the Mishnah says we don't follow the majority in this case. Rather, the majority is obligated to clarify. To clarify. That's correct. Yes, you had a question. What I'm saying is, it is incumbent upon everyone to be as explicit as possible. But we wouldn't have a need for courts or judges or lawyers if everyone was doing what they're supposed to do. Right? Unfortunately, people don't. So what we're trying to do is, we're trying to deal with a case in which people don't do that. And if they don't, who is the burden of clarification on? The majority or the minority? The way we look at it, the Mishnah looks at it, is the burden of clarification is on the majority, not the minority. Yeah. If it's 99-1, we said that's an extreme case where it's obvious that the case is with the majority. What is this now? So now you're asking, what's the borderline? What is a significant minority? Many authorities say it's about 5-7%. I don't know where they get the figure from. But 7% usually seems to be a cutoff. Rabbi Yosef Sholem Elyashiv says 7% is a significant minority. Right? Again, but that's a question of a shayla. Right? That's, like, so to speak, what's the information? I don't know. I would say it's probably about 7%. But we have an idea, though, that's what we mean when we say don't follow the majority. Now, I'm not going to be able to finish with this, because we had a lot to cover and started late, and the next speaker will get very upset if I start late, because that's me. So, just one point. Let me ask you a question. Tosfot asks a question. Tosfot, that was Rashi's example. Tosfot now comes along with a question. Tosfot says, what do you mean don't follow the majority? That doesn't make any sense. Why doesn't it make any sense not to follow the majority? What does it say in the Bible? The Torah says, follow the majority. In what case does the Torah say, follow the majority? A court sentences someone to death. Right? You've got 23 judges. 13 say, guilty. 10 great rabbis, scholars, right, say, he's innocent. What do we do? Right, 13-10, majority. Ignore the minority. They don't know what the heck they're talking about. Goodbye. So Tosfot says it doesn't make any sense. Right, the Torah says follow the majority, ignore the minority. And what's the Gemara saying? Ignore the majority, follow the minority. Ah, yeah, clearly there's a difference. What's the difference? Very good. There are four different explanations of what Tosfot's answer is. But one explanation of what Tosfot's answer is the following. Look, a court is trying to decide the intellectual truth about something. Now, the way you decide truth, generally, is the consensus of a majority of experts in this subject. Okay, so the majority of experts have said the guy's guilty. Now, what does the law say? How do you discern guilt or innocence? By the majority of the court. In other words, Jewish law is identified by the majority of the Sanhedrin, which means once they've taken a vote, what do we say about the minority of the Sanhedrin? It's as though they don't exist. The court has, if I tell you what did the court say, I'll say the court said guilty. You don't care how many votes dissented. You don't care if there wasn't unanimous. If it's guilty, it's guilty. End of story. Right? However, when it comes to the determination of how to use the term jug and barrel, how to sell oxen, did anyone give the right to the majority to determine how to use the English language? Are they making an intellectual decision here? No. Did the Torah say you define humanity by the majority of speakers? No. Right, in other words, when it comes to an intellectual matter and you've got a majority of experts and they've agreed upon it, you are allowed and obligated to ignore the minority. When it comes to a population of real people, right, you can't say the minority doesn't exist. You've got to say the minority exists, even though I'm from the majority, my burden, my obligation is to clarify, and I've got to ask, and if I don't ask, I will lose. So therefore, how do we derive this? And the Mishnah says, jug and barrel. Okay, that, of course, I covered about the first 10 lines of the Talmud, right, with only one of the commentaries. We didn't get very far. There's another 4 pages of Talmud on this particular Mishnah. You're going to have to come back for another Gateway seminar, right, to get the rest of that, because I have to finish now. Thank you very much.